We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
What's happening, Higher Side Chatters and surveyors of the vast landscape that is the World Wide Web? As always, I'm Greg Carlwood, and I thank you deeply for carving out a little place in the next hour of your reality to listen to THC amongst the infinite options, especially with such finely tuned forms of distraction out there as Borderlands 2 and Dread 3D. The point is, my appreciation for this intimate privilege cannot be overstated. Today's guest on the Higher Side Chats graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University and established herself a career as a New York lawyer before taking an unconventional turn down the path of developing and harnessing her psychic ability. Now a trained psychic detective who works with law enforcement, a spiritual medium, channeler, energy healer, remote viewer, seer of auras, and the author of my most recent undertaking, Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. The force is strong with this one, folks. The self-proclaimed skeptical psychic, Nancy Dutertre. How are you, ma'am?
Oh, the force is strong. I'm good.
Nice. Well, you know, your book, Psychic Intuition, it really did a lot to help me understand psychic ability and how it works, because now it seems less like magic or some X-Men ability and more like the idea that psychic abilities like channeling and remote viewing and stuff, they're just kind of the sight, smell, touch, and hearing of a well-tuned mind rather than the body. Would you say that's kind of a fair description?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of the book, is to bring it to a level where, you know, starting with point A, you know, for anybody who's not already somewhere like up somewhere higher up in the alphabet there. Start with point A and get everybody on board, get everybody to understand that psychic ability, as far as I'm concerned, it is not magic. It is an absolute natural physiological ability. And, you know, I don't get into talking about the existence or lack of existence of, paranormal phenomena. That's kind of like a whole other topic. I just talk about our ability to know things. And for me, it's absolutely related to understanding, you know, what sensory perception is.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I took away from your book. But it is interesting that you went down this path, because most people with such a well-established and respected bunch of achievements like Princeton and a successful law practice in New York, they would typically shy away from like social taboos like psychic abilities. So how did this happen for you?
it's kind of a long story, but it was basically just the fact to start working on this book, which I originally thought was going to be a book about the psychology of intuition. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was psychologists really, they don't like intuition too much. They call it other things. They call it empathy, which to me is something really very different. Resonant empathy, transference, countertransference. So they have all these names, and they spend a lot of time sort of avoiding it. Mm-hmm. And they talk about certain like uncanny qualities of knowing things, but then they sort of chalk it up to, well, you know, it's some type, you could imagine what it's like to emotionally connect with your client, and therefore you can come up with maybe similar imagery or something like that. But they don't really get into it, and it's almost they did a lot of discounting of it. Mm-hmm. So I looked into neuroscience. I thought, well, maybe they're taking a look at it, and they really can't stand intuition because it's way too subjective. And that's when all of, you know, my research sort of took off, and I was talking to anybody and everybody who knew anything about intuition. And that's how I started really getting into the whole psychic world. And at a certain point, I realized it's not like another intellectual topic where you can talk about it. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work that way. You have to be inside it from an experiential point of view in order to know it. And then you can talk about it. So I trained for about 10 years. I was apprenticed to a well-known psychic detective, and I studied with a bunch of, you know, mediums and medical intuitives. And it turned out I had some ability. So I the book is sort of all about, you know, if I can do it, anybody can do it. And that it is trainable. We all have this ability. We most of us lose it. Not everybody, but most of us. I was never aware that I ever had it. And I think, you know, that sort of makes a difference in writing about mm-hmm. it, because I come from the other side of the fence.
Sure.
You know, so I have a great amount of empathy and understanding for skeptics. I actually really enjoy skeptics, because they're doing, up to a point, they're doing it's a good service. Mm-hmm. You should always question everything.
I agree. And, you know, for the better part of this conversation, I'd like to talk about some of the major criticisms of psychics and hit them kind of head on, because I think a real lack of that is what leaves people on the fence. And, you know, I kind of want to start with this, because I was on the fence too, and I really have to stay skeptical until I have some kind of personal experience with it. But as I was reading your book, my lovely girlfriend was watching Hell's Kitchen, and Gordon Ramsay does this thing where he tests the chef's palate by blindfolding them and making them guess what they're tasting. And these food experts are wrong like 70% of the time, but nobody doubts the sense of taste. So maybe it is a bit unfair to hold psychic ability to a standard of it's either 100% accurate or 100% bullshit. I mean, would you say that's fair?
I like that analogy. That's kind of funny, actually. I mean, usually the one that people talk about is, well, you know, doctors, physicians, who we hold up to these, you know, they're like gods. They're wrong a large percentage of the time. I mean, nobody really talks about it because they don't want to. But they're not 100% right, and no psychic is ever 100% right. And I explain why that is, for exactly the same reason that, you know, a physician isn't. I mean, you're dealing with, yes, you're dealing with facts, but then you're dealing with this other, you know, editing quality of the human brain, where you got to decide which facts are important, mm-hmm. and then you got to decide, well, what do those facts mean? So you got to put together interpretation. Well, in doing all of that, there's a whole lot of room for going wrong, even if you accurately picked out the right set of data to begin mm-hmm, with.
Exactly. And I think another problem is that with the traditional five senses, it's easy to see and understand the tools of the body that you use for them, you know, ears, eyes, tongue. But you can't really see psychic ability working, so it makes it a little more difficult. But how would you say, how does the mind tap into such information as like a visual picture of something 2,000 miles away, or the message of a spirit or something like that?
If you're asking me what's the mechanism, I can only give you speculation on it.
Sure.
And
what does it feel like to you?
Well, it was really interesting. I mean, in the beginning, when I first started doing this, I didn't have any extraordinary, you know, sensing experiences. Well, I had a couple, but I discounted them. I didn't know what they were. But other than that, you know, I'd say, well, if I'm supposed to like clairvoyantly see something, well, what the heck is that going to look like to me? What I realized is it doesn't necessarily look, first of all, you're not necessarily seeing it with your physical eyes.
Of course.
that's number one. That's really important. And I had always heard mediums, you know, saying, well, you know, I see your grandfather standing, you know, behind your right shoulder and he's wearing a cap on his head or whatever. Right. And I thought that they were all literally seeing somebody there with their physical eyes. And that's just not the case. Most of them aren't. Mm-hmm. They're seeing with their third eye. So then if you don't know what the third eye is, how do you explain that? Well, the closest thing is call it your imagination.
Right. You do that in the book several times. Yeah. I mean, I think that people have a tendency, the word imagination is so loaded as make-believe that it's really just, yeah, it's your mind's eye, you know, the things you can visualize that aren't there. Anyone can do that.
I give you an example because things don't always pop up with this stunning clarity. You know, I've had situations and I describe some of them in the book. There was one time I was... it was very early on. I was just sort of experimenting and exploring this. I was getting a massage at a hotel in Las Vegas. Okay. So I didn't know the woman who was doing the massage, didn't speak with her. And I get this crystal clear image of, it was like a photograph developing inside, you know, right in front of my mental screen. And I'm seeing the image of like sprigs of holly. You know, like the shiny green, sort of emerald green leaves, right. And they're sort of spiky. And then I saw the little red berries on it. I said, oh, that looks kind of like holly. But what the heck? Why am I getting this image? And it was clear as a bell. And I thought, all right, well, let me just experiment. Let me play with this and stop, you know, doing my automatic, you know, discounting and dismissal. Mm. That's what most people do.
Right.
And so I said to this woman when she was done, we hadn't spoken a single word. I said, could I ask you a crazy question? And she said, okay. And I said, you know, I got this image of, I think it's Holly. Now, I don't know anybody named Holly. It's not Christmas time around here. It's 100 and whatever it was, 5 degrees outside. No reason I should be thinking of Holly. But if for some reason, I'm thinking it's associated with you. And I don't know why. And she said, well... before I started this session, I was on the phone with my sister, and she has a friend named Holly who got pregnant, and we're all sort of concerned and whatever, and that's all I was thinking about when I was working on you. So that's an example of crystal clear. You get other examples. I'll give you another one.
Sure.
I was trying to deliver it was a mediumship message for somebody. And I was being asked for more what they call evidence, you know, when you're doing evidential mediumship.
Of course.
So, you know, in addition to kind of identifying who the spirit is, you know, their gender, their age, what they passed of, and you know, physical characteristics, you have to give more than that in order to really lock it in. So I said, you know, and so I go back into my sort of mental screen, and there's really nothing in there. It's almost like I'm looking on the inside of my eyeballs. And I'm saying, well, this is really boring, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing like gray shadows and, you know, the stuff that you see when you close your eyes. And eventually I sort of gave my mind the freedom to sort of just allow the gray shadows to kind of form. And I thought I saw something that looked sort of vaguely like a hand. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of boring. You know, I'm seeing a hand that doesn't particularly mean anything to me. I don't know how to interpret that. But the fingertips were like these long gray sort of smoky trails. Because I'm seeing this on the inside of my eyeballs, trying to make an interpretation, and it's very cloudy.
Right.
So what the heck is that? Somewhere in my brain, and this is where the interpretation piece kicks in, and either you're good at it or you're not so good at it, and I think you can get better. I said, there's something on the tips of her fingers. What would that be? And so when I delivered the evidence to the sitter, the person who I was, you know, telling her about the spirit that was there for her, said, you know, this spirit woman, she's got something on the tips of her fingers. Now, to me, I'm interpreting that almost like those, you know, like those in Southern Asia, they have those like little bells on their fingers that they tap when they're dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
You know, sort of like that. And I said, I'm not sure that that's what it is, but that's what it feels like. This woman nearly fell over. She said, oh, my God, this woman, the spirit who I was telling her about, who we'd already identified, when she was alive, she used to, it was her job to do, to give shows with finger puppets.
Whoa.
Okay? So you can get stuff and you say there is no possible way that could be right, you know, and it's not even that clear in your own mind. And you really, it feels, especially in the beginning, feels like you're making it up.
Well, yeah, I mean, but both those examples bring up, you know, another thing that I think critics focus on, and I know is a big gray area for me. I guess it still kind of is, but how can you discern between random thoughts and actual information? Because I could say, you know, Nancy, I'm sensing your spirit guide. I'm visualizing her. She's a Scandinavian shot putter and wears a top hat and cape. Now, I have that mental picture that came to me, but I mean, does it mean nothing? Like, how do we know which things are visions and which things are just our imagination, I guess, for lack of a better term?
My thing is all about confirmation and feedback, because without that, you are, there is such a thing, by the way, it's just making it up.
Right.
And wrong. So, you know, it's not like, I'm not one of those people who says, oh yes, absolutely, 100% of everything that comes out of your brain is going to be something. Not necessarily. There's an awful lot of brain chatter in there. And by at least giving yourself permission to trust yourself, to go into this place of delivering information that you really don't believe is information. But that's good. You get through that hurdle, but then you got to test it and you got to get feedback. Eventually what happens is through the feedback, you start to learn the subtleties of your brain chatter and of the things that feel a little bit more psychic or less psychic. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who's learning it, I don't think there's any other way to do it except by getting feedback all the time. For me, one thing I began to learn, and this is, it's a really difficult thing to learn. It took me years and years and years. You start to, the images that you get, the true psychic ones, they have a certain persistence. They keep sort of coming back again. And it's not like your brain is consciously thinking, oh, I'm going to think this and make it come back. It sort of comes back by itself. Hmm. And that's how I have grown to trust those particular images or feelings. But even then, you're not always 100%.
Gotcha. And now I'm pretty cool with things like remote viewing and seeing the future and stuff. I definitely entertain the idea that information can be accessed from some type of collective unconscious, but I have a real rough time with ghosts and spirits because it seems like the afterlife is just slamming doors, rattling beds, and waiting for a channel to tell your grandkids you love them. But what are your thoughts on spirits and just life after death in general from the perspective of a channeler?
My feelings in general, I have become really a believer in the afterlife, and I have a much stronger faith in spirit than I ever did, ever before. And I think that in terms of seeing a ghost, I always figured that would sort of be the ultimate, to sort of see seeing through with the third eye. Mm-hmm. But I've seen them all different which ways now. And it's fantastic. But it's almost as fantastic when you sense a spirit in the room with you in a really strong way, or they somehow manage to wake you up and you don't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
And in your mind, your imagination, quote-unquote, or your third eye, is able to see exactly what they look like, right down to the details, the color, the clothing, you know, facial hair, the style, their height, their weight, all that stuff. And you say to yourself, well, that's interesting, but I've got to be making it up. But then you go and you check in a history book and you manage to get a photograph and you say, holy cow, wow. And it matches.
Hmm.
And at that point, you say, I don't need to see with my eyes, although that really actually is a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. You could smell them. That's another thing I learned. you can be touched by them. I got basically just about lifted up off the ground by a spirit who I learned afterwards had been identified by other mediums as a very angry security guard who was guarding a courthouse door. And I was messing around with my little my K2 meter. I think I was running around the door and virtually got lifted off the floor by the scruff of my neck. So you can feel it, you can smell it, see it, hear it. They're all different ways. Weird. And if you start to open your mind to those possibilities, the experiences come to you. If your mind is shut off to it, the experiences do not come to you. It's very, I don't know, it's weird, but that's how it works like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people have experiences that it's really tough to just discredit it all as, you know, as hokey. But, I mean, it just seems weird. Like, what is life like for a spirit? Like, it just seems kind of like they're stuck here without any way of communicating, or with very little ways of communicating. And they're just kind of walking around in our houses and stuff. Like, what do you think life is like for a spirit, having communicated? Have you ever asked one?
No, I never asked a spirit what it's like. I think that my automatic assumption, you know, and this is speculation again on my part, I don't know. But my assumption is that they're living interdimensionally, and that they're sort of crossing a dimensional barrier from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't know that there's, I mean, clearly there's sadness or anger associated with a bunch of, you know, earthbound spirits, and that you can feel it, and you get it, and you sense it. And there's a certain, obviously, you know, the looping quality of certain of behaviors.
Right. That is a theme that comes up pretty often. And I actually was thinking about the idea that, and same with, you know, something like past life regression, where people just feel that they have this, you know, this past life. I almost think that it says something about the nature of time, that time could be, you know, we could be in a bunch of parallel universes, and then once in a while they kind of touch and you see this energy that was doing this activity at one point in history, and for some reason it crosses onto this plane. I've thought that, but you think it's not necessarily like a movie plane. They're conscious beings.
Some of them are, and some of them aren't.
Really?
Yeah. Some of them are just like movie images. And I do think it's like, you know, you're bumping into almost like this inanimate thing. I've actually, I knew somebody who worked in it was a haunted castle, and there was a particular room, I think in this, maybe it wasn't in the castle, it was some other place, but there was a room in this place where there was one of these types of spirits that would just walk from one end of the room to the other, back and forth and back and forth, and it didn't matter if you were standing there, if you were talking to them, nothing. Because they would just perform whatever this, you know, recidivistic thing was, this action or behavior, over and over again. Although he told me that on one occasion, he decided to, this guy that I knew, he decided to stand directly in front of the spirit on its pathway. Mm-hmm. And this was not an interactive spirit at all. The spirit apparently sidestepped him.
Weird.
Around him. So there's some, you know, sensing or awareness on the part of the spirits of our dimension, even though I don't know that they're, you know, 100% into our dimension. I frankly, I don't think so.
Hmm. Yeah, it is a weird thing. But also, you know, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about, you know, language and just all these ideas people have about life that kind of keep them from understanding psychic ability. And something that a lot of my favorite musicians and comics have commented on is this idea that their most creative and brilliant moments, they feel like a receiver of thoughts rather than the thinker of thoughts, sort of along the lines of the muse concept. But how has your psychic development shaped your opinions on just thoughts in general? Like, is every man an island, or are we pulling from some cloud data?
Well, you know my answer to that.
Right.
We all like to think that we're islands, and you know, in the 400 years of empirical thinking, we all assume that we're islands, that you can't get into another person's head, you can't be them in any sense. And my clear understanding now is that's 100% wrong. That we are, you know, it sounds like a cliche these days, because everybody says, oh, we're interconnected. Yes, we're absolutely interconnected. And if you look at us in the sense of energy, all of our energies overlap, and the thoughts that we have, the emotions that we have, generate different energy. And I don't know that it's necessarily electromagnetic, but energy patterns that change the other energies in the environment around them, which would be other people.
Mm-hmm.
So we all affect each other. We all we're all receivers and givers of vibrational data, which is why people can read each other's minds. It's not so shocking. It's also why you can do energy healing work and have a very absolutely real effect on somebody.
Yeah, how does energy healing work? Because one time I went to a Reiki master just to kind of, you know, test the waters with this, because I've been told, oh, you know, you're going to feel amazing. You know, it's the best thing ever for you. And I ended up falling asleep, and then I woke up when it was over, and I was like, I mean, I guess I feel rested, but how does energy healing work, and what kind of experiences have you had with it?
Okay, well, the only thing I can tell you is I'm not trained in any form of energy healing. What I've done is 100% natural.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that, you know, by different people, because I just sort of experiment with it. I have such a hard time believing that it actually works. I'm just constantly sort of in awe.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
I think I'm surprised than most of the people I work on, frankly. I mean, this is weird. But people have told me, when I work on somebody, I mean, it's sort of similar to Reiki, I think, although I think the underlying, you know, what I'm doing is actually very different.
Mm-hmm.
But I never touch. I usually, I keep my hands roughly 5 inches above the surface of the skin. And I am doing a few things. I'm feeling for the site of the injury or the disease or the problem, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And once I feel I've located it, then I work on, for me, it's a form of re-educating that person's energy. So I'm not doing anything. I'm not a person trying to suck out, you know, the bad stuff. I'm not trying to pump in, you know, the good stuff. I'm not doing any of that. I'm re-educating, so that it's very important that the person not fall asleep. You might want to remember that for the next time, because your energy has to participate in its own healing.
Gotcha.
So people have told me they've gotten like very large electrical shocks, and I'm nowhere near them. People feel sometimes that I'm actually on their skin, touching their skin. I'm nowhere near them touching.
Hmm.
There's usually, almost everybody tells me that they feel heat, sometimes cold, sometimes like little tiny shocks or little like pinpricks. There's usually a sense of a magnetic feeling. It's really different depending on the person and also the type of injury or problem that they have. But it's very strange, and almost everybody tells me that they actually do feel better. Now, whether the sensation is something long lasting, I think it depends on each person, and I don't get to stick around long enough to get enough feedback from most people. But I do know that at least in the short term, almost everybody that I deal with is kind of surprised. They feel better, and it every time I'm doing that, I'm saying to myself, because I'm always skeptical, is that like a placebo mm-hmm. thing going on or what? But the fact that they feel things, and usually when they are having a sensation, I will have almost the identical sensation in my hand.
Weird.
Yeah, it's very interesting how it works. So there's a merging of energies that goes on at some point.
Well, you bring up the placebo effect, and that was going to be my comment, is something that a lot of people use to dismiss the whole field of psychic abilities in general. But I take a different approach to the placebo effect, because it seems like if, you know, people entertain the idea that you can will something to happen, and that's really what the placebo effect seems to be. It's almost like a catalyst to doing the real work yourself. Your mind just feels like it can do it, so it does it. I almost think the same about energy healing. Like, if you put the faith that you're being healed, it's really just a way to manifest it in third dimension reality, when really you're kind of doing it yourself, because people seem to have the ability to do that themselves. It's just not something that our society appreciates or wants to focus on.
Yeah, first of all, you tell me one person who has figured out what causes the placebo effect.
Well, right, yeah.
So nobody knows. Nobody knows what spontaneous remission is or spontaneous healing. It happens. People don't know why. So there's no reason, you know, we don't discount a placebo effect. There's no reason to discount an energy healing effect either. And ultimately, who cares? Doing it or the other person doing it, or if you can't really identify them, you know, because they're merged in terms of the energies, fine. I just don't have a problem with that at all. But, you know, let's just take a look at it, because whatever it is, it seems to work.
Right. I mean, the placebo effect should really be some type of validation to a skeptic that the world is not as cut and dry and scientifically rigid as you want it to be, because you got to admit that the placebo effect exists. You can give 10 people in a study a sugar pill, and then 10 people a medicine, and some of those people who got a sugar pill will get better. That's something that you can't just write off. There's clearly something happening there.
Yeah. And also, sometimes, you know, when I've worked on people, and obviously I'm nowhere near their skin or their body, but I'm working on them, I've had people, like, jump. They jump up and they scream sometimes. They say, oh my God, what the heck are you doing? I had people tell me that they can feel tendons moving under their skin. Ooh. Strange stuff that you wouldn't normally say, oh, well, that's sort of an imaginary placebo type thing.
Yeah.
There seems to be something beyond that. And whatever it is that's beyond that is really worth taking a look at.
Agreed. What are some of the more powerful or strange experiences that you've actually had personally with this?
With which? I've had a lot of strange experiences.
I guess the whole field of psychic ability, which experiences stand out to you as the most strange?
There are a few things. There are things that have gone on environmentally, mm-hmm. and there are things that have gone on within me. And I think I talk about, you know, in the book Psychic Intuition, I think I do talk about some experiences early on that I had where I was quite accurate when it came to having information about a person who had ended up, he'd killed himself. And I was so shocked by my own accuracy, because again, being sort of skeptical, I just never assumed that you could get information like that or be anywhere near that accurate. And I felt really spooky to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that feeling of feeling spooky to yourself is sort of what stops a lot of people. It's kind of a weird and creepy feeling, and it takes a while to get used to. So that's more of an internal thing. In terms of externally, what I think have been some of the weirdest, I mean, I think one of the strangest experiences I had was when I was doing it was a paranormal investigation of this the castle in Wales, and they had a medium there. I hadn't really decided that, you know, this was anything that I did, I was interested, but didn't do it. So I was not, you know, out there being a medium at that point. And they decided, they said, okay, we're all going to do table tipping. And I didn't know what that was. But we all went, this was there were about 20 people that had, I think, died that they knew of in this castle. Plus it was converted from it was a tuberculosis hospital for a while for kids. So a lot of kids had died there. But anyway, we go into the basement and there are about six of us sitting around this fairly heavy wooden round table. Mm-hmm. All of our hands were told we got to put them on the top of the table. So you can't hook your thumbs under, you know, once everybody's got to see each other's hands. You were so tight around the table, you can feel your neighbor's knees. And they put a little tea candle in the center. And I'm sitting next to the medium. And she's, you know, sort of invoking the spirits or whatever. And the table, all of a sudden, on a cement floor, it jumps and simultaneously twists counterclockwise. And I would say it jumps maybe 5 or 6 inches. Flips me out. And so I scream. I think the woman next to me screamed. And we get yelled at by the leader of this group. And he says, you know, if you can't keep it under control, then you have to leave because, you know, this is serious stuff. Mm-hmm. But okay. And I decided no matter how scared I wasn't going to, you know, at that point, keep really buttoned up. So the table continued to jump and twist and jump and twist. It did this maybe, I don't know, 5-6 times, maybe more than that.
Whoa.
And then at a certain point, and the lead investigator got so excited, he told everybody stop. He brought down the other team and they put these EMF meters. They had 3 EMF meters that they put sort of equidistantly around, you know, the people sitting at the table. So there's one in between me and the medium and then, you know, the other two placed on the other side. So we go back into this sort of semi-trance state, and all of a sudden, with everybody's hands on the tables, and I can feel their knees, and nobody's lifting any, the table floats up roughly, I'm going to say, about 1.5 feet. So the table is above my head.
Whoa.
And it's higher on my side than it is on the other side. It's uneven. And I'm saying to myself, this has got to be the strangest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
The people standing who were not actually seated at the table, they said later, they said, did anybody see the huge flash of white light that went off over the tops of your heads, over the table? And of course, none of us had seen it. They all saw it, though. And they said it imploded and then went zooming off into the corner of the room. At any rate, this table, it floats back down like it's on clouds. You know, this would have been a really, really, really hard thing to stage. And there were no strings. There were no magnets, no, just nothing.
Right.
And I would have felt somebody moving something underneath the table if they had been. And everybody clearly had their hands on the table, and no one was near enough to the table that they could have done anything.
That is so strange. So, what do you think? Like, I mean, I know it's kind of tough to explain the mechanism, of course. It's like trying to explain how smell works to someone with no nose. But what do you think is happening there?
Well, I can tell you that I realized at a certain point when this was happening that I would know about, I don't know, maybe 10 seconds before the table was going to jump. The way that I knew this was because, and I described this as almost like having a temporary brownout, you know, like an electrical brownout. Mm-hmm. You know, the electricity doesn't totally go off like in a blackout, but it sort of dims out. Mm-hmm. My brain dimmed out and my sight dimmed out. And so every time it would dim out, I knew, oh, the table is about to move. So I am absolutely convinced that it was spirit activity. It was certainly using my energy. It was probably using other people's, but I know it was using mine because I never had that experience before to manifest in our physical world. Also, interestingly, of all of the EMF meters, the one that there was only one that was active. during this whole time, and it was one between me and the medium that had a very high EMF reading, and the others were at zero.
That's an interesting story. You know, I mean, I'm always fascinated by that stuff. I'm dying to have a personal experience of some type. You know, what are your thoughts on things like on time and things like fortune telling and tarot cards and future prophecy?
Yikes.
Do you get into that at all?
You know, I have a deck of cards. Every once in a while, I will, because I really don't know how to do cards, and I have a vague idea what the things are supposed to mean, but I don't really use them. In fact, I have said to people, you know, friends and colleagues of mine who do use them, why do you bother? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just tools.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need them.
You could get the messages directly.
I just try and get them directly.
I mean, I kind of agree. I think the way it works is you can do it with anything, I think. But if you give yourself a framework to speak with the universe, it'll happen. Like if the universe keeps throwing out the number 42 to you and you start to say, okay, when I see that, that means something. You've just given, the universe says, okay, well then if you're gonna operate like that, I know how and when to communicate with you. I kind of think that tarot cards are like, you know, just certain pictures have symbolic meanings and you kind of allow the universe to talk to you a little bit, if that makes sense. That's kind of how I take it.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a combination. I do think that somehow there are probably energies that will enable certain cards to, I'm not going to say manifest, but to be available, okay, to be pulled. In the same way that, you know, with if you're doing paranormal investigations, Frank's boxes, you know, using the radio frequencies, you know, it'll go back and forth sort of scanning, but every once in a while it'll pick up a string of words that will be extremely meaningful. It's sort of the same thing. You're giving, they're tools to allow spirit to manifest using certain either sounds or cards or information. But you can do exactly the same thing with your brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a lot of psychic exercises in the book. Which ones do you think would be most effective in jumpstarting someone's mental aptitude who wanted to give it a try?
You know, I teach this in the New York area. Mm-hmm. And I started out originally thinking I had to start from, you know, kind of like I was still thinking very academically. I got to start from point A and, you know, we got to start with the easy stuff and I'll eventually get up and eventually we'll get to this, you know, the mediumship stuff, which is, you know, the most complex, I suppose, in sort of dealing with spirit energy and that kind of stuff. Eventually I realized, no, I don't have to do that. I can teach anything at any point. It doesn't really matter. Just as long as somebody has a willingness to jump right in, both feet in. I could start you off with mediumship to try and tune in, or I could start you off with psychometry or something really simple just in terms of trying to feel energies. But the whole idea is jump in. Don't be afraid with whatever answer you come up with, and don't be afraid of the answer whether you were right or wrong. To me, that was always terrifying. I hate being wrong.
I can see that,
but
yeah.
It's okay, you know, and you got to be wrong in order to learn.
Nothing is 100%. Even the senses that we know and love, they're not 100%. And it does seem kind of silly for you know, a left-brain scientific person to be like, oh, all that psychic stuff is bullshit because, you know, it's just such a big gray area and it can't be verified. When your own senses that you do put your full stock in for your human experience are so limiting and oftentimes misleading, and you know, it's a that seems even more silly to be like, well, only these tools that I know are inaccurate are the ones that I believe in.
You know, it's kind of like the idea that as humans, we all, you know, if we look at like a red barn, that we all somehow believe that we're seeing the same color red, And the answer is no. Right. Not only do we not see the same shade of red, we don't see the similar amounts of detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm extremely nearsighted. I'm certainly not going to see what somebody who's got great vision sees. Mm-hmm. So there isn't, but we sort of like to assume, it's almost like we have this common understanding as human beings.
Right.
When we talk about red, it really looks like this. Well, somebody who's got color blindness, they're not going to see the same shade at all.
Of course.
So it's a common language, but it's very, very misleading. Our senses really are much more mysterious and much more, they're more subtle than we give them credit for.
And, you know, we're getting kind of down to it. We got like 5 minutes left, but we talked about doing a couple tests on the air, and I don't want to really put you on the spot too much, but is there something that you think would be applicable over the phone?
Yeah, I have three things for you.
Nice.
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold them one by one. Okay. And hang on, I'm going to get the first one. Okay. So all I want you to do, because now I have this item in my hand.
Okay.
And I just want you to, without any kind of, you know, prejudgment or anything, try not to think. All right.
Okay.
That's the biggest thing.
That's
Don't
easy for
think.
Me.
Right. Try to allow, in other words, don't go to the information. Allow the information to go to you. And if you sort of close your eyes and you just try to allow your imagination, or try to see if you use seeing, try to imagine what this object, you don't have to say what it is. That's another big clue.
Right.
But you describe it in whatever way feels comfortable to you. And see what you come up with.
Let's see. Is it something cylindrical, kind of like a pen?
Yes, it has a... Yes.
That type of shape?
Yes.
Huh. Is it a remote control?
It's not a remote control. But... it has, if you were working on an auditory level with the sound of remote control, it would be similar.
Gotcha. Like a microphone?
Not a microphone.
It's weird. I'm very untrained.
You're doing great. You're doing great so far.
Yeah, I just have the imagery of something kind of long, like a pen or a microphone.
See if you can find another sense on it.
Another sense.
In other words, do you get a color? Do you get
a dark
texture?
Color. I feel like I get like a black or a brown.
Okay. Are you thinking that or are you seeing that?
It's hard to say. I guess you're telling me I'm probably thinking it.
I think you're thinking it. Because before you said, is it a microphone? And most microphones are black, so I think you're thinking it.
It could be projecting. See, I feel like to some extent I'm kind of just like guessing stuff.
Right. Well, that's what it feels like.
Right.
You tell me when you're ready to give
I'm
up.
I'm ready to give up.
Okay. I'm holding a long-stemmed red rose.
Huh.
Now, you were 100% right when you said, is it cylindrical like a pen?
Right. I was getting that long, small, like narrow kind of shape. And that's interesting because when I was thinking remote control, I even thought about it like from the side, you know, like the thin side. So that's interesting because, I mean, and of course... who knows? But there are an infinite number of possibilities that I could have picked up, and I could have said, oh, is it like a rock? It's like a paperweight? You know, is it a square? So,
and you said remote control. Now, this is a rose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, auditorily, you have the R-O sound that was coming through. You didn't interpret it 100% the right way, but it was, once you start working with that, that's the degree of subtlety. Okay, that you're working with when you're doing this kind of stuff.
It makes sense.
And you, the more feedback you get on it, the better.
Yeah, of course. Can we do, can I hold an object?
You can do whatever you like.
Yeah, let me, because, I mean, we're doing thing like that last exercise is my ability. My ability is awful. So let me try, let me try grabbing something.
Listen, that's one thing that you should not be doing is putting down your own ability, which is classic, by the way. Everybody does that.
Fair.
And you have to stop. That's really important because in giving yourself permission to do this kind of work, which is really hard because everybody wants to be right because we're used to being right, you got to be really careful.
Okay. All right. I got something. I'm holding something. Am I supposed to do anything special?
No, you don't have to do anything special. You're holding something, and as long as you can edit out dead air, I'm fine with that too.
Sure.
Okay, so here's a sensation that I'm having, which I'm going to describe to you. I just looked at, because I thought you were going to ask me to pull up an object for you. I'm feeling as though the image of the object that I was about to present to you is blocking, it's overlapping an image that I think that you have. But the image that I am getting is sort of like a pyramid.
Okay. That's not too bad. Any other thoughts or feelings about this?
Okay, hang on. Trying to see if I can figure out a practical application on it. I'm not getting a sense of anything under the pyramid shape. But to me, I'm very focused on the flatness of the sides and the point of it. To me, it feels almost almost like a cold, and I don't know, it would be like stone, metallic, something like that, but cold,
okay.
Sheer, no texture on it.
Okay, that's pretty good.
But in terms of what it is at this point, I don't know what it is.
Well, I picked something that I thought would be pretty tough to get. And what it is a little gift shop statue of the Golden Gate Bridge, which has two huge, you know, peaks on it that are very pyramid in shape. They're two triangles, you know. And you said you can't get a practical application because there isn't one except to spend money. And, you know, you said it's pretty untextured. It's pretty untextured. You said cold. I mean, it is metal. I think that's not bad. I mean, considering what I was holding, it seems a little bit difficult to get that.
You know, I did an interview on another radio show, and the host was a real diehard skeptic. And pretty much started out the show, well, yes, so yes, say you're a psychic. Well, yes. So I don't believe in that kind of baloney. So if I were to, I never had an experience. If I were to say to you that, you know, you have a 14-year-old son, that'd be a bunch of, you know, and before he can finish the sentence, I said, well, actually, he's 13 and a half. But thank you for proving my point. And there was dead silence. Dead silence. And he had a group in his studio, a whole bunch of, like, you know, people in there who also contribute. There was, you could have heard a pin drop.
Wow.
Well, but how would I do that again? You know, and the point is, it's very subtle. It's difficult. We don't quite understand why it would work but if you allow the possibilities, they increase, they don't decrease.
Yeah, I think it does have something more to do with an underlying phenomenon within our existence that we just ignore than it does about, you know, special people. I think that's kind of a big problem with the field is that, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, you know, like people get really new agey and they're like, well, I'm special and I sense this and that. And it seems a little hokey to, you know, your average member of American society. And I think that there's too much going on to ignore it all completely. And your book does a great job of showing how language and senses and all that is, they're constructs, and you overlook them, and they carry with them certain opinions that you might not even have, but they go with the language.
Yeah, it's that classic thing that, you ask the fish about everything in its environment, and it tells you about all the rocks and the plants and the other fish, and completely forgets to tell you about the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, you know, that's what we live in. We live in the context of our language. And it does shape the way that we perceive things. And I talk about how actually they've done scientific studies that show if you put a linguistic name next to a color, for example, it will change what the brain, which color the brain decides to call that color.
Right. That's a real creepy thing too. You think your eyesight is what you can trust over any other sense. And I mean, to an extent, you're still using your eyesight, but your brain processes the language before the color, which is what you're trying to see.
Exactly. So people ought to, you know, lighten up a little bit on this stuff about, well, you know, we can only trust what comes to us through our five senses.
Agreed. It's best to just be open-minded. But, you know, that pretty much brings us to the hour. You know, thank you so much for coming on the show. I had been trying to get a psychic for a while, but I was having trouble getting anyone. I think if the show was called Showers of Light or Kundalini Rising, they'd have jumped at it. But I appreciate your willingness to have the conversation. Your book is excellent. Where can people keep up with you and what you're working on next?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. So the name of the book is Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. Anybody can find me on my website, which is theskepticalpsychic.com. And in terms of what I have coming up, oh my goodness, my schedule is going crazy. I'm doing tons of book signings, a lot of Barnes & Noble stores that I'm, you know, doing signings and lectures in. In fact, if anybody, there's a lot of stuff going on. If anybody wants to know, absolutely everything is on my website, mm-hmm. theskepticalpsychic.com. They could take a look.
Perfect. And one last question. Do you have any advice for someone who may have listened to this and be thinking, I'd like to kind of give it a shot, and they want to go see a psychic? Now, there's a lot of frauds and a lot of people. I mean, in capitalism, that's going to happen. I mean, we reward trickery. So do you have any tips so someone doesn't have a bad first experience that turns them off? How can you track out someone who's a little more serious? How can you weed out a fraud? Is there any simple way or any clues?
You know what? Unfortunately, I don't think there is a simple way. I wish there were. And also, I know many extremely talented psychics and mediums who are terrible when it comes to understanding just basic human psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the first thing you want to go with somebody that you feel you have a really good rapport and a trust with, without giving all your power away. Never do that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of finding somebody, they're not licensed. You can go by word of mouth if you know somebody's accurate,
right.
But make sure that they're kind human beings. I think that's really important.
Gotcha.
Too.
And check out the Yelp reviews. Good stuff, Nancy. Thanks again. You've really broadened my understanding of psychics, and it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right.
I really had a good time.
There it is, folks. Nancy Duterte. Check her out at theskepticalpsychic.com. I'm Greg Carlwood. This is the Higher Side Chats. Here's a track from a great little Denver band, Pandora's Pack. My favorite song of theirs, Tiny Little Robots. Stay strong against the cold, abrasive backhand of capitalism and Western society, and I'll meet you in the future, where my next guest, Jason Miller, will be here to talk about his new book, Financial Sorcery, Magical Strategies for Creating Real and Lasting Wealth, something I could definitely use. Also, check out conspiracies.net, great designs for an enlightened mind, the highest quality t-shirts I could possibly make. I'm very proud of the brand. Please do your best to support it. All right, people, I'm out of here. You are fucking welcome. Tiny little robots.